This afternoon, we get to see some of what's going on at the Institute now and some of what is brewing for the future. And you know, it's my pleasure simply to bring on some of the team and let them do things. And we start with one of those brilliant appointments that Kate was boasting quite rightly about earlier on, Professor Ewan Ferney, who came to the Institute less than a year ago and has already been noticed. Ewan... both here and elsewhere. Ewan has this wonderful Fairy Queen in the World project, which you'll all have read about, as the one in which St. George is allowed to be black or a woman, or St. George and St. George, and among many other things. In the year 2004, a very rigorous contest was run, centred in the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa, to name the six most brilliant Renaissance scholars under the age of 40. Ewan had his birthday this year, and so he is now simply one of the six most brilliant Renaissance scholars under the age of 150. This afternoon, he is going to be talking to us on the topic of Faustus with a lawnmower. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. And as Michael says, my title is Faustus with a lawnmower, and with that, 60 years of the highest standards of scholarship at the Shakespeare Institute are ruined. It's the 60th birthday of the Shakespeare Institute. It's, of course, the 400th anniversary of The Tempest. I've been writing a book about the demonic, and one of the problems I've had in that book is how to understand the relationship between extreme demonic experience and ordinary experience. Then, strange though it may seem to say, I remembered The Tempest. And this, of course, is the island in The Tempest, and it's time to get the lawnmower out, but wait. Prospero is Shakespeare's Faustus, or Faustus. His name is Faustus translated. Like Faustus, he is a magician and one who covets superhuman powers and traffics with spirits. Indeed, Prospero goes further than Faustus in virtually displacing God. Unsure where providence divine shades into his own will, he speaks through his servant Ariel in the voice of God. You are three men of sin. But this isn't obscenely and straightforwardly blasphemous for several reasons. One, Shakespeare's play, unlike the Faust myth as such, isn't situated in an ungainsayably, indeed materially eschatological Christian context. No devils lay claim to Prospero's soul, no agencies of grace fight them for it. Two, Ariel is not Mephistopheles or even evil, as I hope we'll see later. Though he's no angel, he's nevertheless a kind of force and voice for good. And three, Prospero's action isn't entirely without moral, even spiritual warrant. He does bring sinners to book and face to face with their sin. To that extent, he can lay claim to a large share of the victory, which Gonzalo describes in terms of restoring the persons of the play to themselves when no man was his own. But even if we leave aside his culpable treatment of Ariel and Caliban, not to mention his own daughter, an aura of obscure guilt clings to Prospero. Perhaps he is Shakespeare's Faustus. And if so, he's a Faust for more ordinary people and experience, and for a more modern, less heroic world. Writing, of course, 200 years later, Soren Kierkegaard recognized that Faust had by then certainly undergone a change. Kierkegaard imagines the Faust of yesteryear turned into a defeated intellectual who can't possibly keep up with the massive expansion of human knowledge in our times. He is in, quote, despair over the relativity of everything. He longs for a vision which, quote, shows him the absolute worth of even the most insignificant thing. This is a quote too. This now is where his despair lies. The way in which all of life now changes for him also shows him to be different from the first Faust. For while with his activist tendencies, the latter sank into sensuality, this Faust will back out of everything, forget if he can that he ever knew anything, and watch cattle, or perhaps out of curiosity, transport himself into another world. In fact, this modern Faust of Kierkegaard's, lost, alienated, is strangely like Prospero, whose transportation to another world, it suggests, could be something of a wish fulfillment. Marlowe's Dr. Faustus was always surprisingly medieval, as compared to the more nascent, tremulous, and still-shaping world of his other more secular plays. Think perhaps of Tamburlaine the Great. So perhaps Faust, in truth, was already belated. Prospero resembles Kierkegaard's updated and somewhat etiolated Faust in that he's a distracted and indeed despairing thinker rather than a doer. The original, as well as Marlowe's and Goethe's Fausts, are rebellious academics who choose to live. By contrast, one longs in vain for Prospero to, quote, sin bravely, as Luther advised Melanchthon, instead of in his own unrelievedly crabbed, resentful and self-righteous way. For all the beauty, power and authority of the Tempest, Prospero's a small-town Faust. Not even that. He's a Faust on a desert island, getting by and perhaps indulging in a little secret study before his enemies land in his lap. There's no flying dragonborn through the firmament for him, no seizing of life in the form of a beautiful woman, as Marlowe's Faustus attempts to do when he conjures and clasps his Helen. Of course, it's possible to rather like Prospero for some of this. He's less flash than Faust, less vulgarly desublimated. He covets life in his jaundiced and paranoid way, not for himself, but for his daughter. He's not irresponsible. He's less of a waster than Kierkegaard's cowgazer. Yes, he's unattractively tetchy and pompous and frustrated, but he's sort of civilized. Don't we recognize the type? Faustus with a lawnmower. There he is, a difficult but doting dad, unclubbable and awkward, his garage full of books. Of course, I'm leaving aside his colonialism, which has been a major theme of recent Tempest criticism here, but let him put on a white pith helmet, and such an earnest and difficult person might very well be qualified to be a colonialist, with all that that entails ethically. Kierkegaard imagines his modern Faust transporting himself to another world. Shakespeare imagines Prospero keeping a colonial garden, with a certain jaded alienation both from the task and from the native he employs in it, though not from the more flatteringly exquisite airborne sprite who also helps him. As a colonialist, he's still very much Faustus with a lawnmower, a figure who brings the demonic home from murder and deliberate traffic with demons to more ordinary political and moral experience. He keeps the grass in check by mutilating it. We'll see, I hope, what that entails for the indigenous life of the island and what follows. What are the origins of Prospero's Faustian sin? He was prime duke in his part of Italy, with all the political responsibility that entails, and guilty of, quote, neglecting worldly ends, all dedicated to closeness and bettering of my mind. To the effect that, as he says, the government I cast upon my brother, and to my state grew stranger, being transported and wrapped in secret studies. Here in Kierkegaard's phrase, quote, the visionary tendency comes to the fore. Prospero also describes his studies as the liberal arts, but there's a very strong indication of esotericism in the strangeness, the secrecy, and in being transported and wrapped. This latter releases another existential meaning in the phrase, to my state grew stranger, one suggestive of superhuman aspiration that brings Prospero closer to other Fausts. But in The Tempest, this ambition results in humiliating failure, usurpation and dispatch in a rotten carcass of a butt, not rigged, nor tackle, sail, nor mast. Prospero feels this outrage so keenly, even so many years later, that he starts to speak of it in the present tense, as if his eyes were clouding over and it were still happening, or happening again. The very rats instinctively have quit it. Marlowe's Faustus goes all out for a more fulfilled life, which proves in the end to be empty, not worth having. Macbeth, perhaps Shakespeare's other Faustus, is an altogether darker figure, not nearly so much of a simple sensualist, and perhaps only interested in fulfilment and kingship as pretext and warrant for his voyage into killing and devastation, even of his own wife and self. Compared to these more sublime figures of positive and negative desire desublimated, Prospero, as I say, is a small-town Faust, a small-time Faust, his sin originating only in the distraction of excessive scholarship. It's true he does raise the tempest, and there's one speech which recalls powerfully magical activity, but it does so in the very act of giving this up. It's carried over from another play, Medea, and its most sensational claim that Prospero can raise the dead is strangely unrelated to the rest of the drama. No, he has essentially lived, as he says to his daughter with wistful chagrin, as master of a full poor cell, and thy no greater father. Faustus with a lawnmower. dad, nothing else. But that doesn't get him off the moral hook, not at all. But what of Kierkegaard's emphasis on, quote, a despair over the relativity of everything? That seems seriously apt to our own plural and globalised world, but isn't the tempest too early for it? Not at all. Prospero's usurpation and exile, his loss of sovereignty, cast him into what is precisely a whole new world of relativity, a world for which he's unprepared, a world that is too new and therefore outrageous to his accustomed conditions and his ambition to know everything to be a brave new world for him. Caliban has a prior claim to it, Ariel, perhaps, a still more aboriginal claim. And then the island itself is full of noises, voices, music, and benedictions. Shakespeare lavishes so much of what can only be called character on the place that it can't be simply and singly known. It transpires differently from a series of what the play almost calls odd angles. Odd because they're irreducible to the organising perspective which Prospero's purposiveness represents. The life of the island is seen, for instance, in the flamboyance with which Ariel executes Prospero's commands, a flamboyance which gestures towards an order of reality that thoroughly transcends those commands. The place is alive in every particular, as Ariel's "where the bee suck, there sucks I" intimates. "There suck I" intimates. Here's a song that creeps into the consciousness of an insect and its pleasures, into a life that is small enough to savour life's worlds within worlds. "In a cowslip's bell I lie," as if our whole life could be located there. "Merrily, merrily shall I live now, under the blossom that hangs on the bough. But get off my lawn." This is the sort of thing that ironizes Prospero's sovereignty and efforts to recover sovereignty, because sovereignty cannot even see, still less experience, such freedom. Things so small as this are quite literally beneath its notice. Prospero's in despair over the relativity of everything. He is most in despair over his own relativity, over the fact that his power has proved so fallible, so provisional. But he doesn't know and doesn't wish to know the half of it. Nor is his scholarship an alternative to the illusions of power. No, the play represents it as related to, difficult to distinguish from, his sovereignty and expectation of sovereignty. Prospero's studies are doomed to fail so long as he fails to realise what Kierkegaard calls an all-embracing total vision where every single nuance is also recognised in its full, that is, in its absolute worth. It is available only passively and mystically, as I think it is to the play as such, though not to Prospero, to a consciousness that concedes the infinite worth and otherness of what is not itself. Thus, the hero of The Tempest, partly because revenge gets in the way, but also because his quest for overmastering knowledge is a quixotic one, is in the ridiculous position of having power over everything, but knowing the value of none of it. The island figures his despairing retreat from relativity into angry isolationism, but at the same time it contests this because it happens to be full of such teeming life. Prospero struggles to recognise life even from its midst. Ironically, in light of Kierkegaard's reflections, he might have saved himself by being a bit more of a cowgazer or a cowslip gazer. I imagine him going angrily over and over his lawn, plotting sweet revenge and vindication, while unmisgivingly mowing down all the cowslips and all the worlds within worlds that they contain. As he does so, he prefers to limit his awareness of the native labouring at his elbow, but he's less happily shut out from the love that is opening in his daughter, like a cowslip. Where is his daughter? The Tempest differs from other early modern Fausts, if not from Goethe's, in that Prospero gets away with it, at least potentially. But how? Well, the play's providence, its word, exceeds Prospero's in requiring him to humble himself, which, of course, he finds very difficult. Ariel and Caliban force the issue. Ariel and Prospero. "Your charm so strongly works them," says Ariel, "that if you now beheld them, your affections would become tender. Dost thou think so, spirit?" "Mine would, sir, were I human, and mine shall. Hast thou, which art but air, a touch, a feeling of their afflictions? And shall not myself, one of their kind, that relish all as sharply passion as they, be kindlier moved than thou art?" What's striking here is that Prospero has to work quite hard rhetorically to remember that he really is like his enemies, that he and they are all human, The transcendent habits of a Faust die hard. The graceless ending of his mask proclaiming an impossibly endless ripeness instructs Prospero further in mutability. In response, he speaks the most famous speech in the play. "You do look, my son, in a moved sort, as if you were dismayed. Be cheerful, sir. Our revels now are ended. These, our actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits, and are melted into air, into thin air, and like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit, shall dissolve, and like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. Sir, I am vexed. Bear with my weakness. My old brain is troubled. Be not disturbed with my infirmity. If you be pleased, retire into my cell, and there repose. A turn or two, I'll walk to still my beating mind." But even this, magnificent though it is, falls short of a real reckoning, because there's a famously wistful beauty about these lines, which complements the world and us. It is a refuge for vanity, purged of mortal grossness, a willful forgetting of the strange, hollow, and confused noise with which the mask truly ended, which perhaps is meant to be suggestive of the way that death rattles in the throat. That all the wispy beauties of the speech give way to less lovely sentences, all confessing a troubled mortality, admits the enduring lesson. "Sir, I am vexed. Bear with my weakness. My own old brain is troubled." The thing is, Prospero still needs to come to grips with Caliban, and I like this painting because, of course, it could so easily be Prospero before he's acknowledged Caliban mine, Prospero in the shower, perhaps. In the Faustian context I've been exploring, it's notable that Prospero and Prospero alone associates Caliban with the devil three times. He claims Caliban was, quote, "got by the devil himself upon thy wicked dam," calls him a devil, a born devil, on whose nature nurture can never stick. And also this demi-devil, recollecting his earlier sensational charge that Caliban is the devil's own spawn, for he's a bastard one, before winding up by unexpectedly acknowledging this thing of darkness. It's always been an important moment in the play, that. But if Prospero is Faustus, then this confession of unity with the demi-devil, or even the prince of darkness he claims is his father, is the more striking and profound. The Tempest has from the beginning forged a slyly ironic counterpoint where Caliban, Stefano and Trinculo, the low comedy, reveal and as it were insist upon the grosser elements of human mortality that belie the main plot on which the Faustian Prospero want to transcend. So the choreography of Act One all leads to a truly wonderful encounter between Miranda and her lover Ferdinand. And then Act Two culminates in what is a clear parody of this, recasting the lovers' mutual admiration as Stefano's drunken presumed discovery of a wonder, but the wonder is a four-legged monster under a gabardine. And then recasting Ferdinand and Miranda's burgeoning erotic relationship as Caliban and Trinculo's grotesque conjunction under the gabardine. And then even presenting what we maybe suppose will be Ferdinand and Miranda's eventual hope for a child, as Stefano's equally inebriated reflection that the monster is venting Trinculo's when Trinculo crawls out from under the gabardine. And this cartoon-style deconstruction of the love plot is, I think, as funny, although it's a kind of slow bomb, and it's as funny as anything Shakespeare ever wrote, but it nevertheless makes plain that they're darkly recalcitrant, untranscendable elements in human being and human love. And these, the play ultimately suggests, are the grit in the oyster of salvation, to which Caliban's arguably closer than Prospero is. It is, after all, Caliban who says, "I will be wise hereafter and seek for grace." And it's perfectly in accord with the Protestant theology that's in the background to all versions of the Faust myth, that he is open to grace before Prospero is, just as he is more sensible of the, quote, "subtleties of the isle" than his demonically isolated master. Luther wrote in the 18th thesis for the Heidelberg Disputation, "It's certain that a man must completely despair of himself in order to become fit to obtain the grace of Christ." Prospero may be in despair in a Kierkegaardian sense, but like all Fausts, he's too proud to be in despair enough. He's still lost in egotistical ambition, whereas rather wonderfully, Caliban is innocent and suggestible enough just to let despair in, and with it, potentially, another source of meaning and value. Despair then operates as a kind of grace in the tempest, but it's too big an ask for any self-obsessed Faust, romantic, suburban, or otherwise. Prospero's epilogue is an interesting testimony to the struggle. It's spoken in rather crude and humbling metre, rhymed four-stressed lines. As you from your crimes would pardoned be, let your indulgence set me free, he says to God, but also to the audience. The sale of indulgences, of course, started the German Reformation. But if an historical aura of suspicion thereby hangs around the word indulgence, that perhaps usefully underscores the fact that any real bid to be saved must labour to transcend the ordinary conditions of the marketplace. To the last, Prospero is trying. He recognises his island very much as a condition of isolation and imprisonment, as well as recognising that he needs to be liberated from it, and that he can't just liberate himself. But can we, after the play is over, imagine Prospero's lawnmower rusting and relinquished and being lazily encircled by bees while the cowslips crop up around it? Or is it easier to believe he takes it with him back to Milan and duly lapses into furious mowing, abstraction, and resentment at home? Thank you for listening.